Hey, everybody. Welcome to another great episode of the OIG Roundtable. We are one short this week. Wade McFall, retired assistant special agent in charge from the OIG and a member of our SIU team, is on some PTO. So I've got my other two compadres, Jason Eisengrein, who is a retired senior executive from HHS OIG and the retired Western UPIC director and our special director in charge, works on some special projects, SIU improvement and the like, and Matt Kachansky, Jason's counterpart, retired senior executive from HHS OIG and the Northeast UPIC director, and is now a member of our SIU investigative management team. Both of them are apparently on a lower floor of the advised conference room because they're wearing winter-esque clothing, and I'm in a t-shirt. I must be on the C-suite, so sorry, guys. It's just kind of the way it is, I suppose. Anyway, we got a lot to talk about today. We're going to talk about an interesting topic, I think, that we've been talking about here a little bit, which is technical violations and the prospect of how technical violations are either treated as a criminal, civil, or administrative matter. And when we talk about it from an administrative matter, we could talk about them from an internal SIU perspective, that it's internally being handled administratively without any ramifications other than potentially an overpayment or corrective action. But from the OIG perspective, an administrative action could be under something known as the Civil Monetary Penalties Law, CMPL, which is taken care of through the Office of Counsel to the Inspector General, or OSIG. OSIG, by the way, is the organization within the OIG that is responsible for overseeing corporate integrity agreements, signing off on some civil settlements that would include a corporate integrity agreement, and monitoring corporate integrity agreements, as well as self-disclosures and the self-disclosure protocol and the like. You know, by the way, we do some training on OIG operations and the different components of the OIG. A lot of people don't really realize that there were about four or five different components of the OIG, all of which have the same mission, which is fraud, waste, and abuse, and ferreting out fraud, waste, and abuse within the HHS OIG programs. But a lot of people don't know things about, for example, the Office of Evaluation and Inspection, OE&I, Office of Audit Services, and then OSIG, Office of Counsel, to the Inspector General. So if you are interested in getting some training for your SIU or your provider team on OIG operations and the like, we can certainly help you with that. But today, the focus really is going to be on these technical violations that are out there. And how they're kind of dealt with from different perspectives. And so, Matt, I want to start with you because I've got a list of about five different types of technical violations that are the more common ones. And I want to start with the one that I think is the one that is most overlooked, and it only affects a segment of coding and professions, and that's instances in which providers are missing start and stop times, right? So while you may not be criminally prosecuted for that, there is that prospect, but start and stop times can be influential in obviously the ability to code certain services. And the ones that come to mind for me are psychotherapy, some other types of therapy, speech, PT, OT, which are some of the timed codes, and then in the telemedicine world, start and stop times, right? And so there is this issue because if a provider is upcoding and they're systemically upcoding and they're not putting in their start and stop times, that could be indicia of fraud, waste, and abuse and the like. So, but it is, in some regards, it can be considered a technical violation versus something that would be treated criminally, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, as you know, in the SIU here, I've run across several cases where, you know, the start and stop times were missing from the documentation, but the documentation of the services was fine in terms of the service was rendered. There was PT, there was OT, there was a psych service provided, but it was still denied because you don't know how long it lasted. And part of the code is it is supposed to go 50 minutes face-to-face with the patient or a 15-minute modality with psych or with PT. And without those things, they're denied. Now, I don't know what the appeal rate is on those, if when they get appealed, but we are obligated to deny those claims and take the education and overpayment actions that you know we're mandated to take. And I think it's a education as part of the job that we need to, that maybe the plans need to do a better job of educating the providers, maybe having internal compliance people in the providers' offices able to show them this simple step will alleviate a lot of those headaches that go with the denials, the recoupments, the appeals, and just get the things paid up front. If you're providing the service, it's a simple step to get it completely documented to allow you to get paid.
Right. And I think we sort of want to bifurcate this out, and we're not talking about E&Ms, evaluation and management, right, specifically, because, right, you got the new guidelines and they're no longer really time-based. It's medical decision-making and documentation. And so, you know, there's some nuances there. And, you know, when we talk about therapy, particularly with physical therapy, 15 minutes is not 15 minutes, right? Yeah. CMS has an entire set of guidance that says that a unit, while one-on-one with provider per the CPT, and we were talking about things in the 97,000 range for coding a PT, while it says one-on-one with provider 15 minutes, CMS has put out some other guidance that says like a unit, for example, in PT is 8 to 22 minutes, right? So it's not inherently 15 minutes. And so, you know, documenting your time shouldn't be seen as a negative. It should be seen as a way to further bolster that you're actually providing that proper documentation for those items, services, and procedures. You know, particularly with things like with telemedicine, even though those fall into the E&M, it's not a bad idea to have your start and stop times, because in the telemedicine world, you know, there's a bunch of other things that are being looked at with that documentation for things like upcoding, whatever. But you brought up a very good point, which is this whole premise of a training, an overpayment with training and education, that, you know, on the payer side, to just seek an overpayment without providing training and education to the provider to fix the problem, right? I talk a lot, and we talk collectively a lot about TPE in the Medicare space, targeted probe and education, which is, you know, we try to push that to our SIU clients all the time. And a lot of work that I do on the provider side, I try to push that on the provider side all the time. You do an audit of records, you identify weaknesses and opportunities, you then provide training and education, and then you do a re-audit, right? In the CMS world, a TPE is three rounds. You get three bites at the apple before the UPIC or the MAC then send you over to a rack for collection. And right, so you've got all this, but there, it really is a piece of the payment integrity puzzle to fix these problems. So Jason, I want to go to you, because when you've got these technical violations that can result in an overpayment from a provider for something that could be cured, that payment integrity, it really needs to have that as part of their focus, training and education, and having people within that payment integrity team, similar to when we talk about having your clinical coders and your documentation coders there, that having people that can provide that training and education becomes part of that whole kind of 360-degree view of payment integrity.
Yes, and everything that we're talking about here. So, you know, I always like to talk about, you know, resource management, work planning. These are things that the director and the management team at an SIU need to keep in mind, because trying to figure out the resources for what you're going to be working on in this particular budget year is very important. And the other thing is that all resources are finite. If you just let your investigators kind of loose to work on whatever happens to pop in front of them, and certainly you want to address the workload that's staring you right in the face, but there really needs to be, you know, a management assessment of what resources you have. Like maybe you're a little light on clinical staff, and frankly, I see that in a lot of organizations, it's very hard to get that the clinical staff that's needed to do a full out medical necessity, you know, some other thing that requires coding or again clinical review. these are things that can be done without those resources, most likely. And of course, investigations can always take a turn where that's needed. But my point is, again, that realizing these types of investigations and factoring them into your work planning is huge.
And to take the education one step further is, you know, it helps the provider. You know, when we were with the UPIC, when we would go on site, we would spend a lot of the time educating them on what we'd, you know, what we were finding. In our overpayment letters, they were dozens of pages long, and most of it was education, claim by claim. This is what we saw. This is what needs to be improved. And we would make sure that the provider understood those things. And that's for their benefit. But it's also, you know, we would go back and look 6 months later, a year later, if the same pattern had was appearing and the same problems were there when we did the medical reviews, that then kind of ratchets up the technicality of the errors then, and brings more of the higher level administrative actions into play, because you're getting closer and closer to intent at that point.
Right. And that's an important piece. Go ahead, Jason.
I just want to add something to what Matt is saying. So clearly it's an obvious benefit to the plan, to the program, as the case might be, but also, you know, we're always hearing about provider abrasion. So having that opportunity to educate, you know, helps as much as not following it ratchets it up. It ratchets down the fact that, you know, you're just always picking on the providers and, you know, loading onto them. You're giving them the chance to, you know, to get it right.
Yeah, I mean, look, the training and education piece, a foundation of training, you know, the three of us have been involved in training and education for a very long time, right? We were all members of the training team at OIG, and you've got to provide a way to do a test, right? You provide training, and then how do you know if that training was effective, right? Let's take it as something even as basic as CPR training, right? I was the CPR instructor for the agency for many, many years. And, you know, you do the training. And if you don't do a test, say 6 months later, how do you know if the training took? How do you know if it was good? You know, it's kind of like in firearms, right? Every quarter you're doing training, defensive tactics, every quarter you're doing that training. If you don't test what you did previously, you have no way to know if that training stuck. And that's where TPE comes in from a payer perspective, is being able to rectify, in some cases, these technical violations, right? That you're giving someone an opportunity to fix something, and it's not a gotcha. And I think that that's where there's potentially that concern, is that you're providing that training and education and then reordering to do that gotcha. And I think, Matt, you know, what you're alluding to is this premise of intent, that if I have an audit and I'm doing something wrong or not accurate, and I get education and training, and I have a re-audit, and I'm continuing to get training and education, and it's not taking, after that second or third round, there's an argument that you just intend to not follow the rules, whether you like the rules or not, because those aren't necessarily the same things, right? It's whether you agree or disagree, it's kind of just the way it is. But, you know, that's where I think you get these issues of technical violations being criminalized. And I think that sometimes when you see instances of providers being charged criminally with something healthcare fraud related that's substantive, you sometimes will see instances of a technical violation being criminalized that wouldn't have otherwise been criminalized. But, you know, the one thing that always comes to mind for me from a technical violation perspective is missing signatures and illegible notes. And I tell the provider clients that we have here at Advise, those are the two technical violations that you should never, ever have to deal with, because there's policies in place. On the CMS perspective, if there are missing signatures on a document, and today with EMR, it's becoming less and less, but with missing signatures, CMS allows for an attestation to be signed for you to say, I didn't sign it, and here's the reason why. And for you to be able to get that put forward as part of an audit or something along those lines. And illegible notes. CMS allows what's called the creation of a transcript. You can basically take your illegible notes, you can type them out, and an attestation that says, My notes are difficult to read. My handwriting is difficult to read. This is what those notes say. And you should be able to overcome those two technical, those technical violations. But the other thing that comes, that always comes to mind as a technical violation that's very hard to not get out of are uncredentialed providers within a group. And, you know, sometimes, and it becomes a hot button topic. And by uncredentialed provider, I mean, you have a group, multiple providers in the group, and only some of the providers in that group are authorized to submit claims to that payer, whether it be Medicare, Medicaid, or commercial payer. You know, you could have a group of 10 providers, and if only a handful of them are credentialed with that payer, then those are the only providers that are supposed to see those patients. And where you get into the problem is when providers that aren't in network, we'll call it, with a particular payer are seeing patients, but those claims are being submitted under the NPI or the Medicare provider number of someone that is in that network. And it could be for, you know, laziness, it could be for nefarious purposes, but it certainly can throw off data analytics, right? If every single patient that comes in, that's a Blue Cross Blue Shield of whatever, if all of them are being billed out under Makachansky's name, but Makachansky is only seeing 1% of them, it looks like Matt's working 40 or 50 hours, right? So I'll get back to it. Data lies, right? Matt didn't actually see them. But, you know, Matt, I want to go to you because this is, this becomes an issue. Like, uncredentialed providers could be innocuous. It could be really a technical violation, or it could range a gambit of things, right?
Absolutely. It could bring, you could be bringing in that these people aren't licensed to do the procedures that that are being billed, or they you know, they don't have the credentials, you know, to run that particular test or whatever it might be. So then you start getting into problems with, you know, patient abuse and harm, which goes way beyond technical. And you, all of those things have to be looked at. So even if it's the, you know, the practice is lazy or just hadn't gotten to credentialing people and they are perfectly capable and licensed to provide the services, the investigative arm is going to look at it as they're hiding this for a reason. And we're going to try and get to that reason. So they're going to be the subject of a full-on investigation for perhaps what is a technical violation due to mismanagement.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the example that I was giving you guys before we started this recording was I worked on a case involving a pediatric group, and there were 10 providers in the group. And this particular payer in New Jersey didn't credential groups, it credentialed only individuals. And this group of 10 pediatricians, two of them were in this particular payer's network. The other eight were not participating. And what was happening was any patient that was seen by those other eight, the claims were submitted under the names and provider numbers for the two that were in the network. A full review was done by the payer. Every T was crossed, every I was dotted. There wasn't a single service that wasn't properly documented. There wasn't a single upcoded claim, services not rendered, misrepresentation. It was, these are as clean as you could possibly get from a claim. The problem was that it was a technical violation. Now, we worked that case with our with OIG's OSIG, and the provider group had to pay back double damages for a technical violation. And it turned out that the applications to get in with this payer were sitting on the desk of the credentialing specialist for the group. It was a laziness thing. But, you know, it, you wind up having to pay the piper for something like that. So, Jason, I want to go to you because as we kind of wrap up and run out of time, you know, from an investigative perspective, sometimes a technical violation like these uncredentialed providers, which, by the way, it could be a technical violation if you've got it like in the case that I was just talking about. But if you're talking about a case where Matt is talking about unlicensed uncredentialed providers, right? Like someone off the street rendering physical therapy to someone or providing some level of care when they're not licensed. And the example that I'll give, Jason, which you'll remember, is our old friend from Staten Island, Dr. Carl Frommer, the ophthalmologist, who had, if you remember, he had an optometrist working for him who was from another country, who was purportedly an ophthalmologist in that country, but had no credentials in the United States and was working as an optometrist, doing eye exams, checking glaucoma pressure, writing prescriptions for glasses and was unlicensed. That's a different ball of wax. But from an investigative perspective, right, from an SIU investigator's perspective, sometimes the only way that you're really going to be able to peel back that onion to know, hey, was the rendering provider really Dr. Matt Kachansky or unlicensed, you know, Eric Rubenstein, is by having good investigative techniques, which include interviews of patients and former employees of the like, right? I mean, sometimes you're not going to be able to peel back that onion because the documents may not show you who the actual provider was.
I guess I get back to that. Technical violations are, you know, the pearl in the oyster. They, you know, they don't generally require a lot of other factions of your resources being absorbed, whether it be clinical data, whatever. But, you know, I will say that sometimes I've seen that there's a perception by some outside, maybe people up the food chain looking down on a particular component. And it's, you know, like, oh, this is just a technical violation. And that comes with then proper packaging of the investigation. So, you know, frankly, you know, an example would be we got beat up a little bit in New York for working technical violations and in Puerto Rico. And well, it was a totally different story when there were 80 arrests of unlicensed, uncredentialed providers in one, you know, one operation. And it starts to send the message that this is a problem. This isn't just picking on an individual provider. So, you know, when you expend those resources to do these things that look like fairly mundane matters, you want to, from the management perspective, make sure you're messaging what the damage is to the program with these fairly mundane issues.
Yeah, look, and I think just to pony off what you just said, I think the difference in that case in Puerto Rico, and it was similar to the case that they did in Florida, where, you know, in Puerto Rico, you had people who were failing medical board exams, but through bribery were getting their licenses. And right, so there's a little bit of a difference there. Like, that's a little bit more of the lesson. If those were people who had failed the basic competencies, you know, the case that was out of Florida, which was a national case that just resulted in a whole bunch of pleas I just saw the other day, was, you know, similar in people were getting nursing degrees from uncredentialed, you know, accredited institutions where they really didn't do any of the work to actually become a nurse. So I think there's a little bit of a differentiator there. But I still think that go ahead, Jay.
Well, I agree with everything you're saying, but again, it's just like being on routine patrol in the borough of the Bronx. Like, you sometimes you stop someone for some fairly minor violation, but that's what investigation is all about. So the point is, would that have been observed if it wasn't for the fact of doing the, you know, some look-see out of, again, a fail, because I can tell you, as being the ASAC over that group, you know, yeah, in the very beginning took a little heat about, you know, probably from somebody like Matt in headquarters saying, like, what are you working, you know, this isn't part of the OIG work plan last time I looked, or something like that. So my point again is that that's what an investigation is about is turning over the stones, looking underneath. And frankly, you know, yeah, maybe sometime it fails to prove out that it's a really big issue and you move on. But in the meantime, you know, it obviously uncovered something that was meaningful to the program.
And I'm assuming that you're talking about some youthful experience I had growing up in the Bronx with a stop and frisk from the local police. But, you know, that's another story, I guess, for another time. But, you know, look, I think the close for me is that sometimes a technical violation has more to it. And then there are often times that a technical violation is really just something that, in the general sense, there's a way to overcome that violation from the, if I'm speaking to the payer community, I'm saying training and education is an important piece of overcoming a technical violation, because working a technical violation that you can cure and rectify works towards your ROI, right? Are you spending your time working on things that have no real benefit when you could fix that problem quickly through training and education? Or are you talking about something that has an actionable level of information? Is it a technical violation on its face, but really you're talking about, you know, unlicensed providers doing the work or something along those lines? So there is that push-pull. If I'm on the provider side, I'm telling my providers, hey, do these audits, fix these problems through training and education, and then when you re-audit, you won't have those problems because you're actually listening to the people training and educating you. And if you've got technical violations, you can fix them. On the payer side, if it's really a technical violation, train and educate your provider community so that you increase your ROI by working on cases that involve, you know, that are worth that time that you're consuming to work on them. So it's an important piece, and it's part of that payment integrity 360 degrees, whether you're looking at it from the provider community or you're looking at it from the payer community. So it's good stuff. As always, it's good to see you guys. I'm hoping that we can pay our bill and get you guys some heat, because it appears that you're not, that we haven't paid the heating bill. If I see that you're pulling wood from the rafters, then I'll know that we're in deep trouble. So
please, sir, can I put another piece of coal in the oven?
Yeah, exactly.
Good seeing you guys. I'll just say 60 degrees in Florida is like 30 degrees in the Northeast. So
I don't know, that just feels true.
Different.
Yeah. Thanks, everybody, for tuning into another great episode. Again, if you're not getting our newsletter, send us an email at hello@adviz.com. We can get you on that newsletter. You can get all of our content, weekly OIG roundtables. You can also grab our OIG roundtables each week off of Spotify, YouTube. You can subscribe to our YouTube channel. Just go to YouTube, put in Advise Health. You'll find all of our previous podcasts, our LinkedIn Lives. We've got a huge agenda for 2024 on LinkedIn Lives. We've still got a few slots also open for our nursing CPC bootcamp, which starts January 9th, I believe, going on for 3 months. There is a discount that's still in effect if anybody wants to sign up and take advantage of the discount through Christmas prior to the course starting. Anybody who has any questions, you can reach out to us at hello@advisehealth.com, and we'll get right back to you to sign you up. We still have a few slots left, but space is running out. So we do encourage anybody who's thinking about doing it to sign up for it sooner than later. And we've got a lot of great stuff planned for 2024. This is going to be it for 2023. It's Christmas, and then people will be taking PTO. So on behalf of the OIG Roundtable team, myself, Matt, Jason, and Wade, who's off today, I want to wish everybody a great holiday season, a happy new year. Thanks for supporting the OIG Roundtable. Thanks to those of you that are our clients and friends. Thank you, and we'll see you all in 2024 for a great year of fraud, waste, abuse, and compliance prevention. Thanks again. Have a good holiday, everybody.
Thank you, everyone.